Well, it's shortly after 5:30, so perhaps we should start. I've the pleasure of introducing to you the winner of this year's Lakatos Award, Professor Larry Sklar of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. The Lakatos Award, as some of you will know, is the premier prize in philosophy of science worldwide. It's administered at the LSE and was set up in memory of Imre Lakatos, who taught in the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method here from around 1960 to his untimely death in 1973, and the award was made possible by a very generous endowment from the Latsis Foundation. The award of £10,000 is given annually to the author of the book judged by an international panel of experts to constitute the most significant contribution to the field of philosophy of science from amongst those nominated, and this year Larry is a very worthy winner for his book Physics and Chance, Philosophical Issues in the Foundations of Statistical Mechanics. Larry has long been established as one of the foremost philosophers of physics through his books Space-Time and Space-Time of 1977 and Philosophy and Space-Time Physics 1985, as well as a whole series of exceptional journal articles. His winning book focuses on what's become had become of late very much the philosophical Cinderella amongst the great triumvirate of at the heart of physics, general relativity and quantum theory having grabbed the lion's share of the philosophical limelight between them. But statistical mechanics, as Larry's book reminds us, is in fascinating detail, raises in especially sharp form all sorts of central philosophical issues about the nature of probability, of statistical explanation, of the role of idealizations in science, as well as inter-theoretic reduction and the direction of time. Statistical mechanics is certainly a theory for which I've long had a soft spot, since it was explained to me that it's compatible with the formation of ice in small corners of warm bathtubs, though only on average once every 10 to the n years, depending on how big you want your ice cube and how big your bath is, for very large n. Now, this enabled me finally to get rid of my duck and lay back happily waiting for it to happen, with, sad to report, no luck so far. Anyway, it's not about my bath time habits, but about some of the general foundational issues raised by statistical mechanics that Larry will talk to us this evening under the title Idealization and Explanation, an Example from Statistical Mechanics. He'll talk for around not more than an hour at any rate, and then there'll be some time for discussion. So, Larry Sklar.
Thanks, John. I think the idea that idealization plays an important role in sciences, and especially in physics, is now well accepted. And the statement is often made, right, that laws of physics don't actually apply to systems as we find them in the world. What they really apply to is systems insofar as they're idealized. And there are lots of reasons for this. Systems are treated as isolated from the rest of the world, but real systems never are genuinely isolated from the surrounding environment. There are multiple forces which act upon any process, right? And it's hard to take count of all of them at the same time. Any one law is going to be neglecting a whole bunch of forces that haven't been taken into account. Realistic systems don't fit the simple descriptions that are necessary to apply the laws and determine the solutions of the equations. This need for idealization has led many people, right, to make some fairly radical claims. One is that the laws of physics aren't true, which I don't think is a very radical claim, because I think we all agree the present laws of physics probably aren't. More radical, right, is the claim that the laws don't even aim at the truth. There have been statements to the effect that physics is not about the actual world, but is only about models, okay? Models being idealized abstracta, right, which bear some relation to the world but don't actually aren't actually found in it. There's another claim, rather, that's gone back some time in philosophy, to the effect that laws of nature shouldn't be taken as statements about the world at all, but rather as rules of inference, and that the rules of inference are of limited applicability, that there are domains of applicability, which I think is connected to these claims that the laws don't apply to physical systems in the world, but only to models. I think you can go too far with these claims. Even if you take propositions about of the laws to be about models, at some point, somehow, sooner or later, we're going to have to ultimately relate the models to the real physical systems in the world. And when we do, we're going to have to characterize the way in which our laws of nature really do somehow or another, in some sense or another, apply to the actual systems in the world. Even though, right, what that relation may be something which is very hard to state explicitly, very complex and very subtle. But I certainly agree, right, that idealization plays a fundamental role, that the laws as we find them apply only to these idealized systems, and that the relationship between the idealized systems and the real physical systems in the world, and therefore between laws and general assertions and what actually goes on in the world, is one of great subtlety and a great complexity. My own work recently has been in the foundations of statistical mechanics, this which is a very fundamental but very peculiar branch of physics. As many of you know, right, the statistical mechanics was the first theory of physics which invokes probabilistic considerations at the fundamental level. And because of the way these probabilistic considerations are invoked, the idealizations that one needs to introduce in order to be able to character to say the extent to which the laws are applicable, to say what the laws are about, can sometimes turn out to be idealizations of a very peculiar and very strange sort. And it's one of the examples of this kind that I want to talk about here. What I want to do is talk about this. The basic problem of statistical mechanics is to understand the way in which systems prepared in non-equilibrium go to equilibrium and stay there. We'll say a little bit more about what that means in a minute.
Okay.
And for most systems, it's impossible, even now in statistical mechanics, to be able to give the laws of approach to equilibrium. But there is one particular system for which approach to equilibrium is a well-understood phenomenon within the theory. It's the approach to equilibrium of a dilute ideal gas, which was studied from the earliest days of statistical mechanics by especially Boltzmann. What I want to show is this, right, that when it comes to understanding why Boltzmann's description of the approach to equilibrium works, what one is going to do is deal with certain idealizations. And the idealizations are going to be essential to be able to rationalize, to explain, to justify the Boltzmannian claims about the way in which these dilute gases approach equilibrium. But there is more than one different justification of the Boltzmannian claims, more than one way of understanding why they are true. The two ways of understanding rest upon quite distinct idealizations of the phenomena. And the justifications they give, the rationalizations they give of the Boltzmann account, although they're not mathematically inconsistent with one another, if they were, one of them would have to be wrong, and neither one of them is wrong in that sense. They're both mathematically impeccable results, okay? But the two idealizations are ones which give rise to conceptually violently incompatible understandings of why it is that this well-known procedure for characterizing approach to equilibrium works. That Boltzmann's description of the approach to equilibrium of these dilute systems when idealized works and works very well is agreed upon by everybody. Question is, why does it work so well? Okay. Let's just talk about what this basic problem is, right? It's very simple, the approach to equilibrium from a non-equilibrium situation. Two examples, right? Simple as can be. Everybody's favorite, right? You have gas on the left-hand side of a box. You pull the partition in the middle of the box. The gas flows out and fills the box uniformly and then stays uniformly filling the box. Another case of approach to equilibrium. You have a metal bar, it's cold on one end, it's hot on the other end. You watch it for a while, what happens? What happens is heat flows from the hot end to the cold end, and you end up with a bar which is warm all over. And once the bar achieves the state of being warm all over, it stays there. Okay? Why do things behave that way? In both cases, right, there's an equilibrium state, an unchanging final state, an attractor state. And when you start the systems away from that state, they rush toward it and stay there as long as you watch. Why do systems behave that way? Okay, there is a standard account of why the systems behave that way, and an account with an interesting theory, among other things, right? It was an account that was known in the 18th century by Bernoulli, who then sort of said, well, one of the Bernoullis who said, well, this is probably the truth, but I'm going to talk about caloric anyway. And then it was rediscovered by Herapath, a railroad engineer in Britain, and rejected by the Royal Society. And then it was rediscovered by Waterston, a British civil servant in India, and rejected by the Royal Society. And then it was rediscovered by Kronig in Germany. And since he was German, people in the Royal Society started paying attention to it. Okay. So let's not worry about the hot and cold. Let's just worry about the gas in the box type situation. Okay. Here we are, right? It's very simple. The gas in the box is made up of tiny little particles too small to see. And they move around inside the box, and every once in a while they collide with walls of the box, and sometimes they collide with each other. A very simple idealized model is of these things having no interaction with each other or with the walls of the box until they touch, and then having a sort of instantaneous reflection, right? Elastic collisions, so-called hard spheres in a box. Everybody knows that's not quite correct. Molecules really aren't like that. They actually interact at a distance. They have potential interactions. But the hard spheres in the box gets you quite far in understanding the phenomena. One of the interesting points is that the reason this model wasn't discovered for a very long time, even by people who thought that the gases were made up of tiny little particles too small to see, is because they couldn't believe that such a simple picture would be right. What there were all sorts of theories of molecules as being, you know, tiny little things too small to see, but surrounded by clouds of ether which interacted in all kinds of subtle and esoteric ways. No, they're just bouncing billiard balls. Okay. Well, all right. Why is it that these bouncing billiard balls, right, approach equilibrium? Boltzmann gives an account of the approach to equilibrium, which is just brilliant, right? He says, suppose we start off with these molecules distributed any way you like in a non-equilibrium condition. Now let's watch what happens when they bounce off the walls of the box and bounce off each other. Okay. You put in the way the molecules make up the gas. You put in the laws of dynamics about how these things bounce off of each other. You put in one additional assumption, and you can get the approach to equilibrium and staying there. Okay. And now comes one of these wonderful German words. There are three wonderful German words that appear in this subject. This is the Stasallansatz, the hypothesis with regard to collision numbers. And it's very easy to understand. I mean, what it says is this. You've got a molecule moving along with a certain speed v, or certain velocity v. What's the probability that it's going to hit another molecule with a certain velocity v prime in a certain interval of time? Answer, take out the amount of space covered by the first molecule within that time, you know, how much volume it sweeps out, and assume, right, that its probability of hitting the molecule of the other kind is simply proportional to the fraction of molecules in the box which are molecules of that other kind. And another way of saying it, right, is before the collision, there's no correlation between kinds of molecules. It's a random chance of a molecule with speed v hitting one with v prime. You put in the Stasallansatz, and you get an equation for the dynamic evolution of one of these dilute gases, and it's just marvelous, right? Among other things, the equation is such that when you put in the formula that corresponds to equilibrium, the equation says it won't change. Just what you want. But he also, right, asked the question, could there be any other state of the system which is unchanging according to my equation? And the answer is no. He proves the H theorem, right, which is a theorem that says any state other than the equilibrium state is unstable, okay, must change. So now we've explained the approach to equilibrium. You start off with the gas in any particular initial state, and it's got to go to equilibrium and stay there. Then the trouble begins, right? Let's see how we go. You get first an objection that goes like this, right? Again, this is an something which has a wonderful German name, right? This is the Umkehr-Einwand, the refutation by means of reversibility. Boltzmann, you seem to have shown that if you start off with the system in any given state, right, it will get to equilibrium and stay there. But now start the system off in some particular microscopic state corresponding to non-equilibrium. The molecules all bounce off each other, off the walls of the box, and it goes to the equilibrium state. But now the underlying laws of dynamics are time reversal invariant. So there's got to be a molecular state, this one over here, which corresponds to the molecules being in the same position they are here, with the same speeds that they have here, but with their direction of motion reversed. And this particular microscopic state has got to go to the time reversal of that initial microscopic state in the first line, which corresponds to a system being in non-equilibrium. So if a system can go from non-equilibrium to equilibrium, it's got to be able to go from equilibrium to non-equilibrium. And you just proved that it can't do that, so something you did is wrong. Okay? Well, the natural response to that is to say something like this, right? Well, my equation isn't about how systems must behave. It's really about how systems are likely to behave, how systems behave with overwhelming probability. Historically, we're in a bit of a quandary here because Boltzmann said a lot of things, and some of the things he said were sufficiently loosely worded that it isn't clear whether he had exactly the right answer all along and people just didn't understand him, or whether he didn't really have the right answer and gradually got closer and closer to it as more and more objections were piled up and he thought about it harder. My guess is it's a mixture of the two, right? That he intuitively sort of knew what was going on but couldn't really express it right until he was put under a lot of pressure. It sounds as if he's saying something like this. My equation doesn't describe the way systems must behave. My equation describes the way systems will behave with overwhelming probability. Now, he doesn't actually say that, but it sounds as though he's saying that. Well, in correspondence with people, right, several people say, but that can't be right either, particularly stimulating correspondence with Colverwell. And there are also interesting correspondence with Loschmidt, and with later on, Zermelo participates in the debate as well. Many other people did. Very fascinating debate goes back and forth. Let's look at the Umkehr-Einwand again, the objection from reversibility. If that state over there goes to that state there, then as we just said, the reverse of the final state in the first line goes to the reverse of the initial state in the first line. But if there, for each transition of the first kind, there is one and only one transition of the second kind. And if you're going to count probabilities of things happening by number of ways in which they can happen, there are just as many ways in which the thing can go from non-equilibrium to equilibrium as there are ways in which it can go from non-equilibrium to equilibrium. So why are you saying it's overwhelmingly probable it will go from non-equilibrium to equilibrium? In other words, the same reversibility objection, but now a reversibility to, an objection to this overwhelming probability interpretation of the equation. But there's another objection as well, and this is a very interesting one. This is the Wiederkehr-Einwand, or the objection from recurrence, right? For certain kinds of systems, of which these hard spheres in a box or any of the kind of energetically isolated systems, which are spatially bounded, is such a system, there is a theorem by Poincaré, which says the following. Start the system in any initial dynamical state whatsoever. Take any distance away from that state you like, no matter how small. Then, with probability one, the system will get back that close to its initial state sometime in the future. And in fact, it will do it an infinite number of times. Okay, so with probability one, the thing will almost recur. Well, now once again, right, we've got a problem, right? Because start the thing in a non-equilibrium state. What that says is wait around long enough, and sooner or later, no matter what it does in the intervening time, it'll be back to that non-equilibrium state or infinitesimally close to it, right? But if the Boltzmann equation, with probability one, but if the Boltzmann equation is describing the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of things, then with probability one, the system is going to go toward an equilibrium state and stay there. And these are flatly contradictory, right? Something has got to be wrong. Okay. Boltzmann comes up with a final version which isn't subject to either one of these objections, although it's got certain other problems with it. This is what he finally ends up saying. He says, here's what I think individual systems do. The line represents the state of a system at equilibrium. Systems, if you leave them alone from time minus infinity to time plus infinity, spend almost all of their time at or near equilibrium. Every once in a while, they fluctuate away from it. The further away from it you're talking about, the more rare the fluctuation occurs, more rarely the fluctuation occurs, okay? So any individual system will, just as reversibility shows, right, have as many transitions away from equilibrium as it has transitions toward equilibrium. The probability of going from here to here is matched by the probability from there to there, just as reversibility says. Also, Poincaré is right. You start a system in some state of non-equilibrium, you wait long enough, you'll find it at a state infinitesimally close to that. You'll have to wait a very long time, right? But you know, if this is any distance away from equilibrium, but it's perfectly possible. So this is what I really mean. Now, of course, there are a lot of problems involved with this we're not going to be able to go into in detail. You look at this thing and you say, but wait a minute, you were supposed to be giving me a theory which explained why it is that living in this world of non-equilibrium that we have, isolated systems go to equilibrium and stay there. Now you're telling us that the world we live in is a world which is almost always at equilibrium and is completely symmetric in time. We started off with a non-equilibrium world in an asymmetric process, and you've given us a picture of a world which is at equilibrium and completely time symmetric. At that point, cosmology and the first anthropic principle get invoked. In a letter, right, in responding to this objection, I think it's a letter to Culverwell, Boltzmann says, my assistant Schütz has come up with the most ingenious suggestion that the universe is very big in space and time, and it probably is in equilibrium almost everywhere and almost every moment, but of course there are going to be fluctuational regions. We just happen to live in one of those fluctuational regions. Later, that gets published, supplemented by two other arguments, right, and Mr. Schütz's name has dropped out of the picture. We all have our foibles, right? You get that cosmological claim, right? And then you get the anthropic claim, and furthermore, you wouldn't expect to find yourself in part of the universe which is near equilibrium because you couldn't have cognizant beings in a world like that. You need energy differences in order to be able to organize cognizers. And then you get the final part, which is, well, why do we find ourselves in a part of the world which is going closer to equilibrium in the future and not running away from equilibrium in the future time direction? And the answer is, what do you mean by the future time direction anyway? You know, what we mean by the future time direction is the direction in which the entropy of our local region of the universe is going up. You get all those things. I've heard this described by some people as one of the most brilliant insights into placing, you know, theoretical physics in a brand new context ever constructed, and by other people as being the last obviously failed, bizarre attempt to rescue a totally failed theory. Take your choice. I don't want to talk about that. Okay, question though. We've got this Boltzmann equation. And the Boltzmann equation describes approach to equilibrium, and the solutions of the Boltzmann equation look like this. And let me cover this part up. The solution of the Boltzmann equation, right, looks like this. Here's the system originally in non-equilibrium, right? Later on, we find it closer to equilibrium, closer to equilibrium, closer to equilibrium. That's what the solution curve of the Boltzmann equation looks like. Question, what on earth is that describing? It can't be describing how every individual system must behave. We've been through that. It can't be describing also, right, the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of a system. We've been through that. What on earth is it describing then? The clearest statement that one gets is given by Paul and Tatiana Ehrenfest in a famous review article in the 1910 Encyclopedia of Mathematical Sciences, right? And here I'll uncover this, right? This represents the concentration curve, okay? What is the concentration curve? Picture. You start off with a vast number of systems, all of them in non-equilibrium. You look at the systems at a later moment of time. What's happened? Well, they've done everything. Some of them have gone further away from equilibrium. Some of them have gone much closer to equilibrium. Some of them have stayed the same, right? But the overwhelmingly largest number of those systems have reached this point of closeness to equilibrium. Okay. Then you look at the collection of systems at another moment of time. Some of them now have gone further away, some have gone closer, some have stayed the same, and so on. But this point represents the closeness to equilibrium of the overwhelmingly dominant number of systems at that time. Okay? So the curve doesn't represent the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of an individual system. Every individual system will eventually get back over, or almost every individual system will eventually get back down here at some point by the Poincaré theorem, right? But they'll do that at radically randomly different times. They won't all do it together, okay? The difference is between the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of a system and the behavior in time of the overwhelmingly most probable states of systems. And those two things aren't the same thing, okay? And it's the latter that the solution to the Boltzmann equation is supposed to represent. It's the course in history of the dominant state of the collection, not the course in history of any individual system, nor the probable course in history of any individual system. Okay. This is wonderful, right? The Ehrenfest thing is wonderful because at least now we have a consistent interpretation of the Boltzmann equation, right? There's nothing in the Boltzmann equation and in its solution, right, which is inconsistent with the principles of reversibility or the principles of recurrence. But of course, let me give you another way of understanding what's being said, and this makes it much clearer. This actually comes out of Gibbs, which is very interesting because the Ehrenfest loathe Gibbs. The Ehrenfest have nothing but nasty things to say about Gibbs, but I think they're inspired by him anyway. The way you describe the situation is this. What you do is you use this gigantic multidimensional space, phase space. At each point in that phase space represents the total microscopic state of the system, right? The specification of position, velocity, momentum for all of its molecules. The collection of points here, the region here, represents all possible microstates of the system compatible with the constraints. It's being in a box, it's having a certain energy, and so on. So, you know, if you've got an isolated system with a fixed energy, endpoint molecules which have three position coordinates, three momentum coordinates, it's a 6n minus 1 dimensional space, okay? What corresponds to a system being in equilibrium? From this perspective, right, we're not dealing with individual systems. We're dealing with this gigantic collection of systems, or rather, what we're really dealing with is probability distributions over microstates of systems. And the probability distribution, which is supposed to represent, in the theory, the equilibrium state, is a probability which is distributed uniformly over the entire allowed phase space region. Lots of questions about what uniform means there. It's a very problematic issue. We're not going to get into that, okay? So that's what corresponds to equilibrium. Probability smeared in a uniformly thick layer of, or thin layer of butter on the toast, right, over the phase space region. Now, here's how the theory is describing approach to equilibrium from this concentration curve point of view, right? We start off with this, right? Here is, this region corresponds to the gases confined to the left-hand side of the box, okay? This region corresponds to the gases somewhere in the whole box with the partitions been removed. And what we would like, right, is to be able to say this probability distribution here, uniform probability spread over the smaller region, will eventually flow to this here, right, the equilibrium distribution, probability uniformly displayed, spread over the now newly available phase space region. This is non-equilibrium, this is equilibrium. We'd like to say this becomes this, but we can't, okay? Because provably, that can't happen. There's a basic theorem, right, the fundamental theorem of statistical mechanics, which says the size of this region of probability never changes, no matter what happens as time goes on. It can't spread out in that way. So what are we talking about then when we're talking about this concentration curve interpretation? Well, Gibbs says, look, here's what we're really saying. It's something like this. Start off with a glass, right, and now we're not dealing with the phase space, we're dealing with an actual physical system in the world. We got a glass and it's 90% full of clear water and 10% full of oil-based ink, which doesn't dissolve in the water. And then we've got this fundamental experimental device, a spoon, okay? And we take the spoon and we stir the water and we end up with something that looks like that, right? It's sort of uniformly pale blue all over. But it isn't really, right, because it's insoluble ink, okay? What's really happened is this. If you look at any region of the glass at a later time, some region that's small but not too small, and you look very closely with a magnifying glass, you see every point in that region is either in clear water or in ink, okay? But the ink, although it hasn't dissolved in the water, there is no pale blue fluid, there's either dark blue fluid or transparent fluid, the ink has mixed in the water. Okay? Mixing. It's mixing that we want to account for. Here we go. Here was the probability distribution over our initial system, right, when it was confined to the left-hand side of the box. Now what happens to that probability distribution as time goes on when we pull the partition? Answer, it turns out to look something like that, okay? The thing spreads out throughout the newly available region in a kind of ever more complicated way, just like the ink does in the water. Every point is still either in an empty region or in a region that's, got the probability in it, and the total volume of that probability-filled space is the same as it was in the beginning, but it has spread out over the available phase space in a coarse-grained way. If you could show, here's a mathematical way of characterizing that very simply, right? You start off with the probability confined to a small region of the phase space. You take any other region of the phase space, A. What you want to show is that if you wait long enough, the amount of A filled by points that were originally in that probability-filled region will be the same fraction as that probability-filled region was of the original space. That's the sense in which that thing up there spreads itself out evenly in the coarse-grained sense. Okay? If we can show that probability ensembles for these realistic systems or idealized systems will behave like that, then we can do something. See, before what we had was, look, the concentration curve interpretation says that Boltzmann's equation is consistent with dynamics when interpreted this way. But the question is it true? And can we show that it's true, right? Well, if we can show that mixing occurs in the phase space, then we'll have shown that it's not only consistent but true. And all you have to do is show that nicely idealized physical systems are mixing. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not so easy, right? But eventually, people can do it. And it's a wonderful, wonderful bunch of stuff. Some of the names: Krylov, Hopf, Kolmogorov, Sinai, and so on. Basically, here's a wonderful, pretty picture which I copied out of a book, right? This represents a system, right? A system is evolving in time. As time goes on, right, that phase space points that represents it is moving. This red plane represents another bunch of systems that start off with their microscopic state very close to the microscopic state of the system in question. As you go into the future time direction, they diverge in their microscopic state from the system we're focused on in an exponentially fast way. And the blue plane represents another set of systems which are such that they have their microscopic state very close to this one we're concentrating on at this time. But as you go into the past, their microscopic state diverges very far, exponentially fast, okay, from the system you focused attention on. These are systems whose trajectories in phase space have exponential instability to them. And they're sometimes called C systems, Anisov systems, mustache systems. They're dynamically unstable systems. The same kind of instability plays a fundamental role in chaos theory at the macroscopic level. Okay? What you can show is that if a system is has that property, right, for its trajectories, then it will be a mixing system. And you can do it for, once again, certain idealized systems. What idealized systems? Well, hard spheres in a box. So not too far away from realistic molecules. But, right, what does that actually show? It's very interesting, right? First of all, okay. Actually, for more realistic systems, you can't prove mixing. In fact, you can probably prove that it doesn't really occur. So there are very deep questions about the legitimacy of this idealization of hard spheres in a box. Secondly, the results you get are completely symmetric, come out of the underlying dynamics, and the underlying dynamics is time reversal symmetric. So the results you get are completely time symmetric too. If the system mixes into the future, it mixes into the past as well. But the Boltzmann equation correctly describes how things behave toward the future. It doesn't describe how things behave toward the past. What's going wrong? Why is it that all this stuff works when you apply it in one time direction and not in the other? And then finally, right, the one thing I want to focus on, does this show that systems will, as a matter of fact, get toward equilibrium if we represent their behavior in this evolution of a probability distribution in the way we've been talking about? Well, when you actually look at the mathematical definition of mixing, what it says is, here is what happens in the limit as time goes to infinity. So you can prove, right, from this dynamical instability stuff that mixing occurs, all right, but you can only prove that it occurs in the infinite time limit. And that doesn't tell you anything about what happens in between. For example, even if the system was hard spheres in a box, so that mixing was rigorously applicable to it, mixing is compatible with the following. The gas is in the left-hand side of the box. You pull the partition. The gas just sits there for 6 billion years. Then it rushes up into the left-hand top corner of the cubic centimeter of the box, and it sits there for another 3 trillion years. Then it does this wild sort of dance around the box, right? Sort of keeping within 1 cubic centimeter, it goes from corner to corner in a cyclic rhythmic pattern. That happens for the next 40 quadrillion years. Whatever you want, right? All that's compatible with mixing. It's just that in the limit as t goes to infinity, the spreading out has to occur. A very interesting idealization, right? What we have is a kind of uncontrollable idealization here. This is going to be crucial to all of this, right? There are some idealizations where the theory itself says, now look, what I'm going to tell you only applies in the ideal case. But my theory also tells me, right, how different realistic cases are going to be from the ideal case. As opposed to uncontrollable idealizations where the theory says, here's what happens in the ideal case, don't ask me about the realistic systems. Okay? And there is an element of that uncontrollable idealization going on here. Okay? Okay. This is fine. What I want to talk about, though, is that much more recent, well, the stuff on mixing, long history, right, and the ideas go back almost to Maxwell and Boltzmann and to the Ehrenfest and to Gibbs and so on. More recently, there was another approach to understanding why the Boltzmann equation works. Okay? It's very subtle, it's brilliant mathematics, and there's something peculiar about it that we'll see. Okay? This is called the rigorous derivation of the Boltzmann equation. Look, I already said mixing only applies as t goes to infinity. One thing that's annoying about that is it doesn't give you a derivation of the Boltzmann equation, it just gives you a derivation of a kind of infinite time approach to equilibrium. It doesn't say this is how it's going to get there. We would like to be able to somehow say, right, now we know why it not only gets there, but now we know why it gets there in a finite time, and now we know why it gets there in the way it does. You know, we want a lot more than what mixing tells us. Furthermore, right, the mixing results don't say anything about the initial probability distribution and how it's distributed. They're going to apply no matter how that initial probability is distributed, okay? But we know that what the probability distribution is going to do in a finite time, how it's going to evolve, right, is going to depend upon what that probability distribution looked like at time zero. Initial conditions or probability distribution over initial conditions has to play a fundamental role. Well, in the Lanford rigorous derivation of the Boltzmann equation, you get the whole thing, right? You get the Boltzmann equation as the correct description of the phenomena. And the derivation is dependent in an essential way upon special initial conditions holding, which is exactly what you want, okay? But of course, the Lanford derivation only applies in an idealization. Otherwise, why would I bring it into this talk, right? Very special idealization, one that's been around for a long time. It's called the Boltzmann grad limit. It's actually due to Grad, but, you know, Grad says, look here, this is what Boltzmann is really doing in a lot of his work, right? You let the number of particles in the gas, the number of molecules, go to infinity, okay? You let the size of the molecules in the gas go to zero, where if you take, right, I mean, the size, if you let the size of the box be measured as having unit one, and then the diameter of a molecule is d. So you're letting d go to zero at the same time n is going to infinity. In the process, however, you keep the number nd squared constant. Okay? Now, since nd squared is constant, n is going up and d is going down, that means nd cubed goes to zero, which means that in this limit, the gas has zero density. Right? Just like in Boltzmann's original thing. But this is stronger than merely the density goes to zero because it requires, and it's essential that it requires, this nd squared equals constant, okay? And now what he does is this, right? He takes a set of equations which are called the BBGKY hierarchy. There are a set of equations which rigorously describe the evolution of the behavior of the system. There is a function fn, which is the function which says everything there is to say about the probability of distribution of molecules. You know, it says things like, what's the probability of finding a molecule in this region of space and in this region of velocity, given the positions and velocities of every other molecule in the gas? That tells you everything about the probability distribution function. Then there are these reduced probability distribution functions, the bottom of this one being F1. That just says, what's the probability of finding a molecule in this region of positions and speeds, forgetting about anything else, the unconditional probability. And it's the behavior of F1 that Lanford takes the Boltzmann equation to be describing. Okay. What we want to show is that in this Boltzmann grad limit, F1, right, will behave the way the Boltzmann equation says it's going to behave. Now, of course, right, to get that, we're going to have to put in special initial conditions. And very ingenious stuff, right? There are all kinds, there are different ways of specifying what these initial conditions are. In other words, you have to say what the initial probability distribution looks like. And there are different ways of doing it. Some of them are time symmetric, but if they hold at time zero, they don't hold an instantaneous amount of time after zero. Others are time asymmetric. But each one of them is so constructed that you get, right, this asymmetric evolution of the probability distribution, which is what you want, right? Now, how is that compatible with the reversibility objection? The answer is it's compatible with the reversibility objection because you've now specified certain restricted classes of initial conditions. What you've said is I'm only going to pay attention to the following initial conditions. So you can get the time asymmetry in that way. Very nice. Okay. Okay. What Lanford derives is that if you start with a probability distribution which has an F1 value, which is at a certain point on the solution curve of the Boltzmann equation, then for some time into the future, in this limit, okay, the F1 value will follow the solution curve of the Boltzmann equation with probability 1. Okay? Okay, for how much time into the future? Well, that's unfortunate, right? For what amount of time can you prove this? Okay. There's some molecules, right? And typically the molecules are going around and they're bouncing into each other. And molecule here hits one molecule and then it bounces off, and a little while later it hits another molecule and bounces off, right? And it takes a certain amount of time between this collision and that collision. Well, take the average of that time. That's the mean free time between collisions. Lanford proves that his result holds for a time beyond time zero, which is equal to 1/5 of the mean free time between collisions. Which, you know, of course, is not what we're interested in, right? That's a tiny, tiny fraction of time compared to the amount of time it takes for the system to go to equilibrium. But you can't always get what you want, and that's the best you can get, right? The main thing to notice is, right, what he says is this is the kind of behavior you get with probability 1. You know, we have been lectured from Ehrenfest on, don't go around looking for overwhelmingly probable behavior, right? Look only for evolution of overwhelmingly most probable state. If you're looking for overwhelmingly probable behavior, you can't possibly get it. That contradicts the Poincaré recurrence theorem. But what Lanford is saying is no, the Boltzmann equation is describing the overwhelmingly probable behavior of the system. When the system is sufficiently idealized for 1/5 of a mean free time between collisions. Okay. Now, okay, you might think that the right answer here is, well, look, who cares? This only applies for 1/5 of the mean free time between collisions. That's why the idealizations don't really conflict with each other. But it's not as simple as that, right? It's actually more complicated. Lanford says, and I will have to go on his authority on this, things can be true even if you haven't proven them. And looking at the structure of the proof, He says, I believe these results can be extended for reasonable times into the future, beyond this, you know, very short time for which I can actually prove the result. He doesn't say it, but he might even have in mind that you can extend these time, you know, these results arbitrarily far into the future. Suppose that's what he means, okay? Would he then have a blatant contradiction with the recurrence theorem? Right, it sounds like it, because he's saying with probability one, the thing will follow the Boltzmann equation, i.e. get closer and closer to equilibrium forever. The Poincaré theorem says, oh no, it won't. With probability one, it'll get back to where it started, almost. Ah, well, no, because remember, this only applies for this idealized system. Okay, number of particles has gone to infinity, density's gone to zero, diameter's gone to zero, and so on and so forth. And as Joel Leibowitz says in an article on this, look, when you've gone to this limiting case, you no longer have the underlying phase-space flow picture, which is essential for deriving the Poincaré result. So even if these results are extended arbitrarily far in the future, you still won't get a mathematical contradiction, right, with the Poincaré result. But there are other subtleties here, and this is quite interesting. I think this may, I'm not sure about this, but I think this may be the crucial way in which this result also suffers from uncontrollable idealization. It goes something like this. Look, for that little tiny time interval, if this is the way the idealized system behaves, systems not very, you know, not too distant from that idealized system have to behave almost that way as well. But what happens when you extend the thing arbitrarily into the future? Basically, you could only apply these results, which hold for this idealized system, to a non-idealized system if the limiting results that you get in this proof, right, the proof hold, the such and such behavior holds in the limit, if you could show that that limiting process was what the mathematicians call uniform limit, okay, in time, and it isn't, and there's no reason to believe it is. And so, you know, Leibowitz and Lanford both say, look, even if you can extend this thing into reasonable times, you know, beyond that 1/5 mean-free time between collisions, that doesn't mean that just because this Boltzmannian behavior has been shown rigorously to hold for this idealized system, that you have a right to say that something close to it will hold for any less idealized system, no matter how close to the ideal it gets. Okay? So you have something very much like, in the mixing case, I prove that something occurs in the limit as t equals infinity, but that doesn't tell me anything about what's going to happen for the next 6 sextillion years. Okay? Here, you have something that says, if I can extend this result beyond this, you know, tiny, tiny little time, it tells me what will happen for reasonable times into the future for this idealized system, but it doesn't give me any information whatever about what will happen for systems which are not quite that ideal, no matter how close to it they get. Once again, right, an uncontrollable idealization of a different sort. Now, okay, so we have these two results, and the two results are both mathematically impeccable, right? Each one of them, you know, they, in some case, ways, they make the same idealization, right? Both of them are working with hard spheres in a box. Interestingly, for the Lanford result, some of other people have gone around and said, well, we can weaken that. We can use, you know, more realistic molecular interactions. The result still holds. Okay. For the mixing result, you probably... Nobody knows whether you can do that or not. Even making sense of what you'd want to prove is a very hard thing to do, but for various reasons. But of course, they make radically different idealizations in other directions, right? One of them deals with what happens in the limit as t goes to infinity. The other one deals with what happens in the limit as the density goes, as the diameter goes to zero, the number of particles goes to infinity, nd squared stays constant, okay? they rely upon radically different idealizations, and so, you know, you can't get any sort of mathematical incompatibility between them. You know, they're not saying getting the same result for the same up on the same premises, right? But something very strange has happened here, right? We wanted to know why it is that the Boltzmann equation and its solution describe the way things really behave in the world. Certain, you know, reasonably dilute, reasonably large number of molecules, reasonably close to hard sphere molecules. When you prepare them, you know, in a non-equilibrium state, they go toward equilibrium. The Boltzmann equation works. Why does it do it? They give probabilistic rationales for this, but the probabilistic rationales are diametrically opposed to one another, right? One of them says, because that's the way the evolution of overwhelmingly most probable states of systems like this behaves. The Boltzmann equation solution describes the concentration curve. It is no way, shape, or form a description of the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of an individual system. The other one says, no, what that equation is giving us in its solution, right, is a description of the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of individual systems. And the Ehrenfest were simply wrong-headed, right? Which one is the correct idealization for accounting for the phenomenon? Either one? Is there a notion of correctness here? If there is, what is it? Okay. Each one rests upon uncontrollable idealizations. So any hope of saying, well, we can discover which one is correct by going into the laboratory and performing experiments is just plain nonsensical, right? What are you going to do, go into the laboratory and wait till time goes to infinity and see whether Poincaré occurrence recurs or whether the thing goes to equilibrium and stays there? What are you going to do, go into the laboratory and build a system in which the molecular diameter has gone to zero? Okay? And the mathematical results are impeccable. Of course, if you could build a system that met the premises, right, and do the measurements that meet the conditions on measurement imposed by these things, you'd get the results the two theorems tell you, right? But which one of them is the appropriate one to make resort to account for the fact that for reasonably large systems with reasonably small molecules, right, with reasonably hard sphere kind of interactions, the Boltzmann equation works reasonably well for reasonable times to describe the behavior? I mean, why this particular case appeals to me more than some other cases is because the very mode of probabilistic explanation that's being offered is not the same, right? One says it's overwhelmingly most probable behavior, the other one says it most certainly is not. It's, right, behavior of overwhelmingly most probable states, which is quite a different thing. I'll just end up with three quotes, right? First is by Joel Leibowitz in an article on just this, on the Lanford rigorous derivation of the Boltzmann equation. It's a well-known quote. I do not know if anyone is making bets on the eventual resolution of the apparent paradoxes relating to the coexistence in the description of the same phenomena of both determinism and randomness, reversibility and time asymmetry, and so on. If there are people betting, however, I would be happy to be the banker and keep the money until everyone has agreed on the matter. Okay. The next quote was brought to my attention by my father-in-law, and it's from Leo Kadanoff, a recent paper on not this topic, but another topic in statistical mechanics. He ends the paper with the following sentence: models are fun, and sometimes even instructive. And then finally, this quote was brought to my attention by my colleague David Hills, and, you know, sort of reference to the fact that the Boltzmann equation has been around for 100 years, and he got it very quickly, and we all know it's right. And 100 years later, we're still trying to figure out what on earth it's supposed to even be describing, much less why it describes it correctly. And this is one from E.E. Cummings: all ignorance toboggans into no, and trudges back to ignorance again. Thank you.
Well, we I do have time for questions, but maybe there are some people who don't want to stay for the question time, so perhaps we should just halt for 30 seconds or so while anybody who has to leave leaves. We shan't carry on the discussion too long, since champagne is definitely an attractor.
It's a strange attractor. Well, not strange.
It's relatively strange in my life, you see, but anyway, it's an attractor. We do have microphone Z. Yes? Certainly. Oh, well, a microphone. Where's the other one? If people who would like to ask a question could make themselves known to me and or to George, who holds the microphone, then everybody will be able to hear their question as well as Larry. Does anyone would like to? Paul Costell over there. Where? George, sorry, you moved in to the wrong corner of the box.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Perhaps you could say who you are, Paul.
My name is Paul Castell. I'm from Wolverton College, Oxford. There's another idealization in statistical mechanics that's bothered me, which you didn't mention. And I also think it's an uncontrollable idealization. And it's this, namely that the microstate of the statistical system, certainly in the classical case, is very sensitive to outside influences.
Sure.
In particular, gravitational influences. There are results like the one calculated by Borel in 1928 that say that if you move a tiny 1 gram mass on the star Sirius or something, that within a millionth of a second of the influence arriving on Earth, the microstate will be completely changed by that influence. So it strikes me that somebody might simply say, well, these are results all very well that are based on the underlying dynamics, Newton's laws, but suppose the actual behavior of the microstate is so different from that of a one which assumes that the system is totally isolated from the influences, that you might as well assume that there are totally different dynamical laws that govern the microstate. Does that bother you?
The interventionist approach is certainly a very common theme, okay? That basically systems approach equilibrium. Why? Well, because they're continually being randomly kicked from the outside. And that's why, right, reversibility is a total myth. Okay, that's a long theme. Many people have brought it up. It keeps coming back up again and again. It has a very problematic aspect, though, which is very interesting, right, which is there are situations where we get what looks to us, for all intents and purposes, like the ordinary approach to equilibrium that we're familiar with in general, but where we can prove that whatever is going on there cannot be accounted for by intervention from the outside. Why? Because in these special cases, we can actually make the reversibility take place. Okay? Spin echo experiments, plasma echo experiments. The spin echo experiment, you take a bunch of nuclei and you line them up by a magnetic field. They're in a crystal lattice. You kick them with the right angles to the magnetic field. The moment you do the kicking, the bar has a magnetization due to the fact that all these little magnets have their axis of rotation pointing in the same direction. They start precessing around the imposed magnetic field, and eventually, in the plane in which they're now residing, they point at random in all directions. The magnetization goes to zero. That looks like ordinary approach to equilibrium. You then hit the thing with a radio pulse of the same sort, but twice as intense as the one that kicked them into that plane in the first place, and it flips them over 180 degrees. So the nuclei which were fastest in the precession race and got furthest ahead are now furthest behind. But they're still precessing at these varying different rates due to the same local inhomogeneities in the crystal, right? And the net result is, if it took time delta t to go from they were all lined up, non-equilibrium, to they were randomly directed, equilibrium, you wait another time interval, delta t, and they're all lined up again. And the situation has gone from equilibrium to non-equilibrium. And if there had been, you know, intervention from the outside, which was responsible for this initial approach to equilibrium, which had really randomized these things, the information about their initial parallel or organization would have disappeared, and it hasn't. It's all still there. So either you've got to say one of two things. Either interventionism, either this case of apparent approach to equilibrium before you did the flip, is a standard case, in which case, since interventionism can't possibly explain it, it can't possibly explain the standard cases, okay? Or you've got to say, intervention is the general, or you may say, right, intervention is the general explanation in the other cases, like the gas in the box and so on and so forth. It isn't the explanation here, but this doesn't count as a standard case, right? This is an interloper which has to be treated specially on its own, blah, 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 okay? I don't have a definitive answer as to which one of those is the right way to go. My own feeling is that the first my inclination is to think the first answer is that this is an indication to us, if not a conclusive proof, that even in the other cases where there is intervention from the outside, I mean, you know, you can't do a real Loschmidt reversal for molecules in a box. You can't freeze them all in position and reverse all their velocities one by one and let them all run back into the left-hand side of the box. But you can do it for these spin systems. You can do it, in another sense, for certain plasma systems. There's something called plasma echoes, which I don't really know much about physically. And I think that is indicating that to us that even though, of course, there is all this random kicking from the outside in the other cases, it's not the core of the explanation of approach to equilibrium. My guess is that even if we could turn gravity off, the gas on the left-hand side of the box would still flow to fill the whole box and sit there. Of course, I can't prove it. Yeah?
If you speak very loudly, sorry, I got the microphone away from you.
My idea wasn't that intervention could explain the approach to equilibrium. I think it probably can't. My worry is that all the other approaches that you mentioned assume that systems are isolated from the surrounding. And it seems to me that that's a false idealization, an uncontrollable one. So even if you had an argument that said, actually, this particular way of going is quite good, then I'd come along and say, well, actually, that's an uncontrollable idealization, namely that it.
That's hard to say. I think, you know, one response might, if you were perfectly happy with any one of these accounts, and of course I'm not happy, you know, perfectly happy with either one of them for all the reasons we said, I think, you know, the response might be, well, of course, what that shows, right, is that the degree of external interference from the outside is sufficiently small that we don't have to pay attention to it, and we can idealize it away, because after all, here we have a good theory which, making the idealization right, correctly explains the way things actually work. Again, I think there are lots of issues there, but I think that idealization is at least more controllable. Obviously you can't shut gravity off altogether, right? But it's a more controllable situation than going to time equals infinity or going to number of particles is infinite and density is zero. Because there are degrees of intervention. There aren't degrees of infinity or degrees of zero. Right. That's why.
Yes, Irina. May I? I don't know if you hear me.
Yes.
Yes, all right. I would like to answer this. No, I'm sorry. I would like to answer the principal questions. Why it is so that Boltzmann's theory described our observation in such a...
Irina, hold
on. I can't
hear.
May
I
speak without?
No, you no. Just hold it. You keep letting it slip.
All right then. I would like to answer the principal questions. Why is it so that Boltzmann's gas theory, Boltzmann's gas theory is describing our observation in such a proper way? I think that the answer is in the anthropic weak principle that we are living in a fluctuation where entropy is increasing. Because, you know, according to Boltzmann's gas theory, there are the whole universe is in a state of equilibrium, but there are some worlds which have some fluctuations. And we people could live only in a fluctuation where the entropy is increasing, when the second law of thermodynamics is describes the proper world. Don't answer, because I have another remark. The other remark is this, that there is, you can't say that there is a symmetry between irreversible and reversible processes, because, you know, Poincaré said it, and you know this very well, that the difference between irreversible and reversible processes lie in the time of reverse. If the time of observation is a short one, then you could only observe that where the processes go reversible. And when the time of observation is a long one, then we call them irreversible. But this is a symmetry. It is a kind of symmetry which lies in the time of observation.
The answer to the first question is yes, entropy does increase. Yes, the second law of thermodynamics, at least in the stochastic sense, is true. But you can't use that to explain these results. What you're trying to do is to understand why entropy increases and why the second law of thermodynamics is true in the first place. And so to posit that it is to simply say, I'm not going to bother and try and prove these results. What you're trying to do here is to understand why entropy is increasing, and you can't introduce it as a posit. And the second, I don't understand the distinction between reversible and irreversible for the microscopic dynamics of the system is one that's true for any time interval, no matter how small. And if the claim is that if we waited long enough, just as in the Boltzmann picture, we would see, right, that as a matter of fact, there was symmetry in time of processes, and that we just happened to be on, you know, sort of one leg of this curve, and that there would be other legs of the curve if we wait long enough in time, or if we look far enough away in space, where things are going entropically in the opposite direction. I think my response to that is that right? I don't know. I haven't waited that long enough or looked that far. As far as we've looked in the universe, right, what we've got is entropy always increasing in a parallel time direction, fluctuations put to the side, right, everywhere and at every time. Now, of course, you can get into all the cosmological stuff, and is this the result of the Big Bang, and is this the result of special conditions at the Big Bang, and low entropy at the Big Bang, and so on. I have other things to say about whether you have the cosmological way out works, but I don't think we want to get into that. On the anthropic account?
That's what you started, that was the first question. We are the people who live in, these observations are observations made by people who live in a particular part of the universe. That's what I think the question is about. Restating, saying it again, so you...
I'm not sure, I mean... The weak anthropic principle could the only way I can see that to be invoked here would be if you believed with Boltzmann that the universe was generally in equilibrium. The weak anthropic principle could be used to explain why it is that although equilibrium is so pervasive, we find ourselves in a non-equilibrium state. The answer is, right, if it weren't a non-equilibrium portion of the universe, we wouldn't be around here to see it. That's what Boltzmann says. That part of the argument would certainly be true were the universe generally in equilibrium. But as a matter of fact, as far as we know, it isn't, and we don't need to invoke the anthropic principle because, as far as we know, Boltzmann is wrong in his claim that the universe is generally in equilibrium over long stretches of time and vast stretches of distance. Now, maybe we haven't looked far enough or waited enough time, but Boltzmann's in introduction of cosmology into the issues, or rather Schütz's introduction of cosmology into the issues, was extremely important and extremely stimulating, and Boltzmann's introduction of the anthropic argument and the what do we mean by the future is the direction which entropy is increasing were extremely interesting and important. But as far as his cosmological speculations went, as far as we know, those were wrong. We're not in an equilibrium universe.
No, I'm sorry, there was a list of people now, so I think follow-ups are not allowed anymore. Please.
I'm Sang-wook Yi at LSE. You started with some initial remark that there are some emphasis of the modeling in the current philosophy of science discussions, and the modeling seems to replace the status of statements about the scientific theories. I mean, the modeling or model or model building process seems to replace the status of a traditional statement view of a philosophy of science. But and you move into the some kind of level of idealization. So you say something about the uncontrollable idealization, mm-hmm. which is contrast to the some kind of realistically controllable idealization. It seems that you wanted to say something about the relationship between the usefulness or some kind of how can I say, productivity of modeling or some kind of mm-hmm. particular modeling with the type of idealization, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure whether I can catch that kind of point.
I don't have anything definitive to say about it, right? I guess what I would say offhand is something like this. When we are dealing with models and idealization, and we are asked, but what on earth does all our description of the way models behave have to do with our original project in science, which is describing the way the world has to behave? When the idealizations are of the controllable sort, we automatically know in which direction to go to start filling out the answer. Let me explain to you why, although I'm dealing with a simple harmonic oscillator and there really aren't any simple harmonic oscillators, why talking about simple harmonic oscillators is very informative about how this ball on a spring behaves. Okay? When we are dealing with these idealizations which are uncontrollable, I think there are very deep problems that we face when we are asked the question, well, that's all very well, but what has anything you've shown have to do with an explanatory account of the way realistic systems behave in the world? Okay? I don't think the proper response is to say, since your idealizations are uncontrollable, what you have done can't possibly be relevant to the real aims of science. But all I wanted to show here, right, is that it is a completely non-trivial job to say in what way it is going to be relevant, and that's pointed out by the fact that in this case we have two different uncontrollable idealizations, which not only describe the situation differently, but which proffer completely contrary probabilistic models of the structure of the explanation, right? Again, you know, take the nice cases like shell model of the nucleus versus liquid drop model of the nucleus. Of course, right, the things they say about the nucleus in the idealization are inconsistent with one another. You know, one of them says it's a continuum with surface tension, the other one says it's made up of individual particles, right, traveling these shell-like trajectories and so on. But there, right, we have a lot of resources to be able to say to us, here is when it's appropriate to use the liquid drop model, here is when it's appropriate to use the shell model, here's why this one does a good job for you in such and such circumstances, you know, the right ranges of energies, the right kinds of experiments, here's why it fails for others and the other one does a better job. infuriating about this case, right, is you're trying to explain the same thing. There's no obvious, you know, you're not going to be able to get out of this mess here, right, by saying, oh, well, Sinai, or Kreloff and Sinai on mixing are offering us a different perspective on the situation than Lanford in the rigorous derivation of the Boltzmann equation. It's under different experimental circumstances, in different ranges of, energies, with different experimental apparati, right, that the two models are going to be applicable. That's why, although they are incompatible with one another, right, the incompatibility is not disturbing to us. This one, they are trying to account for the same thing, the fundamental applicability of the Boltzmann equation and its solution. And in doing so, they are not simply offering us, you know, slightly different versions of the story, as they would be, you know, if you said, well, look, here's my idea of the intermolecular potential. Somebody else says, no, I think it's more like this. No, they're giving you a completely different conceptual understanding of what on earth it is the solution of the Boltzmann equation is describing from a probabilistic sense. I think all this is meant to show is that such radical idealizations can put us in a very perplexing situation when we are asked the question, that's a very pretty piece of mathematics, what's it got to do with the world?
Michael next.
Yes, well, I just wanted to come back to the Boltzmann's original derivation of the Boltzmann equation, and sort of tie that in a little bit with what Paul Castell was saying. And the problem with Boltzmann's equation, of course, is that the Stossonensatz you mentioned downright conflicts with the fact that collisions inevitably generate correlations in the gas. And the Stossonensatz says essentially there are no correlations. And so the problem of getting the Boltzmann equation is how do you get rid of the correlations? I mean, that's the sort of, and now all these tricks, the mathematical tricks and so forth, are attempts to deal with that problem. Now, the most obvious suggestion is, oh, well, you export them to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is roughly the point that Paul Castell was making. But now I'd just like to make two comments on that obvious suggestion. And it would certainly deal with Dr. Worrell's bath, because his bath being a subsystem, it could actually, you never get the ice cubes forming, but something very peculiar might go on in the rest of the universe to make that come about. But that's the point, that if you export the correlations to the environment, the whole problem resets itself if you take the environment. And so ultimately you've got to think of the whole universe, if you like, as the total environment of any subsystem. And then you're left with the situation that although you may get thermodynamic behavior for these subsystems, the whole universe, the entropy, is just fixed and constant, the so-called fine-grained entropy. So my first question is, does that worry you? That thermodynamics only applies to Dr. Worrell's bath and not to the whole universe.
Yeah,
that's my first question. The second comment is just about the spin-echo experiments, and I don't really agree with you that they don't show the effect of the influence of the environment, because the echoes are attenuated. If you go on reversing the field, you get attenuation, and this attenuation is correctly modeled by the interaction between the spin systems and the lattice vibrations, which are their local environment. So that it seems to me that shows very clearly the effect of washing out. It is a question of the correlations which enable you to reverse the spins. If you wash them out, interaction with the lattice vibrations, in fact, you can't do the reversal. So that seems to be rather a good example of how interaction with the environment, just the lattice, does actually explain the true thermodynamic behavior of the spin system.
No, I mean, the answer to the second question is the most direct one, which is, of course, the system of lattice nuclei is not completely isolated from the other external environment. There are lattice phonons and so on. In the original version, there are spin-spin couplings, although later you can do spin echoes, even allowing for spin-spin couplings. And yes, the echoes eventually get smaller and smaller and smaller and disappear. And the explanation for that plainly is dissipation of the correlational information into the external environment. Then nobody's going to question that. The problem is that just between first lining them up and the first recurrence of an echo, right, enough correlation has been preserved to get the echo back, even though in the first delta T, right, there seemed to be an approach to equilibrium which for all macroscopic intents and purposes looks like ordinary approach to equilibrium. If it is representative of, generic of, ordinary approach to equilibrium, I'm not saying it is, but if it is, then in ordinary approach, what that shows is you can have ordinary approach to equilibrium without dissipation of correlations into the environment sufficient to break reversibility. Okay, that eventually, sooner or later, the thing loses, right, the correlations to the external environment, that will happen, that everything is interacting with the outside world, and sooner or later there is dissipation, is plainly correct, sure. And yes, the answer to the first question is, yeah, it certainly bothers me. I think this is more than that, right? In order to get, I think there are lots of questions about the interventionist program, right? One of them is that, as you say, when you get to the whole universe, who's interfering with that? Does that mean you're going to take a static entropic view with regard to the whole universe? There's one question. Another question is, in order to get the interventionist thing to work the way you want it to work, at some point, it's also going to have to be time asymmetric. And if you just put the interventionism in as kind of randomization in a time symmetric way, you would, by parity of reasoning, be able to derive from the interventionist view, right, the idea that if we have a system which is quasi-isolated, right, and it's in a certain state of non-equilibrium, we ought to infer that in a short time in the future it will be closer to equilibrium, but we also ought to be able to infer that a short time in the past it was also closer to equilibrium, which is wrong. So even in, you know, constructing what the interventionist theory is, there are a great number of subtleties having to do with, I mean, essentially, in the non-interventionist program, when push comes to shove, the deepest question is, why are certain probability distributions over initial states of systems legitimate, but the same probability distributions over final states of systems totally wrong-headed? Okay. In the interventionist program, right, you're going to have a parallel question, which is why is a Stassel-Ansatz with regard to non-correlation of the internal microscopic state of the system and the external environment prior to the intervention legitimate, but not a post-Stassel-Ansatz? So you're going to end up with, you know, I think basically the interventionist program, even if it worked, would itself give rise to a kind of a duplication at another level of the problems, the fundamental problems faced with the non-interventionist program. But once again, right, I am not at all convinced, although I'm, you know, not certain, I'm not at all convinced that interventionism is the first thing to bring into play when you're dealing with systems that we treat as isolated. And again, you know, the most crucial reason for that, the thing that bothers me the most is that spin echo, we have a system which is isolated enough to do Loew-Schmidt reversal. Not forever, no, but, you know, for a while. Or 99% of Loew-Schmidt reversal. And if that's a typical system, that shows that interventionism can't be the right explanation. You maybe want to say it's not a typical system. You know, it's a weird anomaly. Let's not pay attention to outliers. We all know what they do to statistics, right?
Well, with apologies to some other people who wanted to speak, I think this better be the last question. It's Jeremy Butterfield.
I want to follow up your answer to the previous gentleman's question.
The microphone's on, Jeremy.
That's what I can hear. Well, other people can't, I guess.
Sorry. Yeah. Is it on? Yes. So my question is this. You were saying that the two main programs reviewed in the talk offer a completely different conceptual understanding of the justification of the Boltzmann equation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in which this is, I certainly agree, namely that one is a T infinity and one is a zero volume. But I think you may also have said that there's a very different way in which they're radically different. Namely, one is about probabilities of individual systems' histories. The other is about histories of most probable mm-hmm. states, where one means the most probable state of a system at a given time. About that second difference, isn't there less of a difference than those words make it seem? Because if you have two times and maybe 100 systems, and at the first time 90% of them are, so to speak, in state A, and at the second time 90% of them are in state B, then most of them must have gone from A to B. I mean, if one has a certain population of persisting systems and one has a collection of statements, each of them synchronic, about what's most probable at the time for that, for the individual time considered, then there are constraints that will thread together these synchronic, this collection of synchronic statements.
So it will be true. Well, but I mean, certainly it is possible for the curve to be describing the concentration curve and not to be describing the overwhelmingly most probable behavior of an individual system. Because if the systems really are obeying the Poincaré recurrence theorem, then over a sufficiently long period of time, right, the probability of any one system getting closer and closer asymptotically to equilibrium, right, forever is zero. Nonetheless, right, the curve is that curve, which is getting asymptotically closer and closer to the maximum entropy flat line, right, is describing the evolution of the overwhelmingly most probable state of the ensemble at any given time. Now, of course, if that curve were describing the probability one behavior of individual systems, it would be the concentration curve as well. Right, it's the concentration curve interpretation is a much weaker interpretation than the overwhelmingly probable interpretation. So it may be true that between any given time interval, right, n and n plus one, most systems which are, I don't want to say that because I'm going to get wrapped up in a chain of quantifiers here, which is going to leave us trying to sort it out for the next 25 minutes. I think clearly the remarks I made show, right, that they are not the same interpretation, and that the concentration curve interpretation is plainly logically weaker than the overwhelmingly probable interpretation, simply because in the Poincaré recurrence case, not only is it not probability one that the systems will follow that trajectory, it's probability zero.
Well, other people who wanted to ask questions can try and grab Larry at the reception which follows this. This is now in the senior comm room, John? In the senior comm room where various awards will be made. As some of you know, John, is that? One. Well, I mean, I thought there were always two, and there's this filthy lucre and a nice non-filthy medal.
Different senses of multiple awards.
I mean, two awards to one person. As many of you will know, there's an informational analog of entropy developed by Shannon and others. And I'm sure you all agree that within the relatively isolated system of this room, entropy has decreased very strongly as a result of what Larry's told us today, both in giving this wonderful lecture and also in his very full replies to your questions. So I think we should thank him very much.
Thank you.